Good afternoon. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. I'll be conducting this meeting from a standing position today to assert authority over the subject matter.
Dominion.
Wills.
Perhaps not. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Coghill, Ramris, Samuels, Holmes. Ruenberg will be coming along a little later, and I think that Representative Dahlstrom is excused because her husband is another one of his series of bionic reconstruction surgeries.
Hope it goes well.
Yes. And so with that, I would encourage the members, a lot of sugar, a lot of caffeine, stimulating subject matter. Before us, we're going to take up trusts and LLCs. We have Jane, as usual, is ever ready, studied up, and knowledgeable on the subject matter. We have three attorneys with us who will be assisting us in, with all three bills. Dave Schaftel, Douglas Blattmacher, and Richard Thwaites, if I'm not too hard on their names, and then the Attorney General's Office in Anchorage, Mary Ellen Beardsley is with us. I don't anticipate a lot of public comment or testimony, but we will nevertheless host the public as they chime in on this subject matter. So Jane, if you would kind of steward us through the order of what we're doing today, and
the first bill,
we're good to go.
96.
And we're going to take up 196, and I don't believe it has to be adopted because it's brand new.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, Judiciary Committee aide, and I will briefly introduce this bill because the brain trust is really online. It's one of three bills written to keep the state of Alaska competitive in the trust market. HB 196 will accomplish the following. It'll provide that a penalty clause for contesting a will or instituting other proceedings applies even if probable cause exists for instituting the proceedings. This is probably the most controversial thing in this bill, and it is a change because it was unenforceable before. It amends 1316-680A. Change one of the statements that must be contained in an affidavit to be used by a decedent successor to collect personal property from another person. The statement indicates that the value of the entire estate does not consist of personal property valued at less than $25,000, excluding vehicles with a total of $100,000. And that adds new subsection to AS 13-33-101, non-probate transfers after a person's death. AS 1333-101D protects life insurance contracts and retirement plan debts of the individual and from claims of creditors of the individual who was insured under the insurance contract or who participated in the retirement plan. AS 1333-101E describes situations where 1333-101D applies. AS 1333-101F establishes that 1333-101D does not limit the rights of the owner of the life insurance contract to pledge or assign the benefits as collateral for the owner's debts. And 1333-101G defines life insurance contract and retirement plan as it applies to this section. And then Section 5 is the transitional section for this bill.
Representative
Sanders. Would you like questions after the people testify, or?
Sorry.
I could ask a question now, and then they could answer it during their testimony to make sure.
Okay, how about that? That's a good
whatever you'd
format.
Like,
that's a good format. I need to get familiar with the gentleman. Are you with us?
You have a nice trip.
This is Richard Thwaites. I am.
Yes, and this is Dave Schaftel. I'm online.
And Douglas Blattmacher's online.
All right, and gentlemen, so we'll have members, to keep it lively, we'll have members pose questions as they arise, and then if you would just reintroduce yourself by your first name now that we have you on the record, as you weigh in on this. And just to be clear, Mary Ellen, Ms. Beardsley, are you with us?
Yes, I am here online at the LIO.
All right. Welcome to all of you. We're delighted to have you. We look forward to addressing these three bills that are before us today in as prompt a fashion as possible. So with that, gentlemen, whichever of you feels that you're most appropriate to respond, please jump right in. Representative Samuels, what was your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm reading the sponsor statement, not the bill itself, but the way that I understand this is even if you have probable cause for contesting a will, you could be penalized in the will for doing so. So if you had a parent with dementia, one sibling writes the will and puts a penalty in there saying, I'm going to get the millions of dollars or whatever, and my brother Jay isn't going to get nothing in the will, even if there's complete probable cause right there, you could put a penalty in the will, which would stop even the contesting. And what size of penalty? I mean, if there's a $500,000 penalty, you just de facto have eliminated any argument, even if there's probable cause in the will. That's my first question, just kind of a conceptual question.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Samuels, this is Dave Shaftel. I'll start with this one, although I didn't draft this particular provision, but we have a similar provision dealing with trusts. These types of clauses are very common. What they're designed to do is if, Representative Samuels, for example, you wrote a will, and you wanted to make sure that your beneficiaries did not challenge that will. You also wanted to make sure that nobody challenged a will just for the purposes of getting into a negotiating situation, which unfortunately is more common than we'd like to see. Then you would put in a provision in there that if one of your beneficiaries didn't like what he or she received under your will, without running the risk of forfeiture, they could not raise a challenge, even if that challenge had no merit to it. They couldn't create a challenge by filing a lawsuit in order to get into a negotiating position where they could try and put pressure on all the other heirs to settle with that person in a way that was unfair. A lot of people feel that when they write a will or a trust, they don't want their children or grandchildren squabbling over it. They don't want somebody coming in, for example, that they may say, I want to give more to this child than that child for one reason or another. Maybe the child needs more money because financially they have problems, or medically they have problems, or they have more children than the other child, or they were more attentive to the person who's drafting the will than the other child. And they don't want that other child coming in and filing a frivolous lawsuit just to leverage a position to be able to get a settlement out of the other children so they'll go away. And this is very common, these kinds of provisions. Now, the problem with them is that the statutes that we had said, well, if you have probable cause, you can go ahead and do that anyway. And that became a very large loophole. And so people would go in and they would challenge it, and even if it was frivolous, they'd argue they had probable cause, and it just created more litigation. So what the experience that many practitioners have had is if you talk to your client, and what I do with my clients, I say, look, we can leave in this probable cause exception, or we can take it out. If we take it out, that means that you can put in your will and say, look, children, you're getting these shares. And if you file a lawsuit challenging it and you lose that lawsuit, you're not getting your share. That's the penalty I'm putting into my will. And so a person has the right to do that. Now, you know, they also have the right to say no if there's probable cause. I mean, I know that's a big hole, and maybe it'll result in litigation, but you know, I'm going to leave that in. You know, they have that choice. Now, I want to distinguish this situation, Representative Samuels, from the situation you posed, because that would create other problems where you have a, you know, I forgot exactly your hypothetical, but it was either a child or a cousin or a nephew who came in and enticed a person to write a will in a certain way. Now we're talking about duress or undue influence or incapacity. Those are a whole bunch of different issues, and all those can be challenged and should be challenged if that kind of abuse occurs. This would not in any way protect against that. So if a beneficiary sees that there's been or argues there's been undue influence, that's a different situation than a situation where we're constructing a will here.
So if my sister were an attorney, drafted up Dad's will, Dad signed it because he trusted his daughter, daughter got all the millions of dollars that I wish my dad had. That would not be probable cause. I mean, if you couldn't draft it that way, even though everybody, he signed it, it's a sound mind. He just trusted his attorney daughter.
Well, there are presumptions when you have a family member who drafts a will and that family member benefits from it. There's strong presumptions that that's invalid, and that family member has to overcome those presumptions with strong evidence. So that family member would it would not be wise for the daughter to be drafting the will in that situation, and if somebody challenged it, it would be a heavy burden for her to carry to show that she didn't exert undue influence. Those are different situations than what we're talking about here, which is protecting against frivolous challenges that are basically blackmail. And maybe that's a strong word, but they're basically to create a situation where a family member can get a settlement that he or she's not entitled to.
Thank you.
I think Representative Holmes had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, are there other statutes that address what you're talking about? I mean, all we have here in front of us, although we might have it somewhere else in the bill packet that I'm not haven't flipped to yet, but what we've got here is just the section 1312.517. But you're saying that there are maybe other provisions somewhere that would address.
Yes, in the same title 13. I don't have the section in front of me, but the Alaska legislature has done exactly the same thing as what's being proposed here for trusts, and that's been Alaska law for some time. In other words, the same provision existed with respect to trusts, which had a probable cause exception, and that has been eliminated for some time in Alaska. So what this is really doing is bringing wills on par with trusts. So you could create a revocable trust instead of a will. This proposed provision would apply. So you could create a revocable trust and say in it, I don't want anybody challenging this, probable cause or not. Challenges my revocable trust, they will forfeit their inheritance if they fail.
I'm not sure of the process, but this is Richard Thwaites. I was wondering if I could respond to Representative Samuel's question as well.
And then after you do that, then I think Representative Holmes has another question to chime in on.
Thank you.
Go ahead to Representative Samuels.
The issue that Mr. Shaftel talks about has been complicated in recent years with the addition of elder law and disability law. And many practitioners now have the need, because of special needs trusts and the like, to disinherit a particular member from the main part of the will in order for the special needs trust to stand and do its purpose with regard to the person having the beneficiary having a disability. So we often look to this disinheritance sort of language as kind of a penalty clause, and this would tend to cover that, allowing practitioners to safely create a special needs trust specifically for the benefit of a disabled adult or even a minor in those circumstances. So it's something that's probably developed in the 90s that has that we talked about in the trust area and dealt with in trust area a number of years ago, and would like to see it likewise in the will, which makes the planning a little easier when you have a family that doesn't really need a complicated estate plan because their estate isn't necessarily that large, but may in fact require at least a portion of that to be available for a disabled adult parent or child, either one. And it has become an increasing need as these areas of the law evolve. But that was an additional reason, I think, that that has developed probably in the last 10 years.
I think Representative Holmes had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a sort of a follow-up to the earlier question, could you direct me to the statutes that would lay out the exceptions for things like duress and undue influence? We were discussing the difference between somebody who's contesting a will because they don't like the outcome, they don't like that they've been disinherited, versus somebody who might, where there might actually be duress or undue influence, and you were telling me that 13-12-517 would not keep those kinds of contests from occurring. Is there a statute that I can look at that clarifies that?
And then members of the committee, there aren't specific statutes that I'm aware of that lay out those causes of action. Those are really case law causes of action. So I can't point you to a specific statute dealing with that subject. I can find the statute dealing with trust, though, if you'll give me just a minute here.
And if I may, on that line, I assume then that you're saying that the similar provision that deals with trust maybe has been litigated in this area, and there might be case law showing that that has not been held to preclude challenges for things like duress and undue influence.
Well, I don't know of any litigation in Alaska so far on that subject. Now, maybe one thing that I'm not explaining very well here is that if you bring a meritorious claim, you're going to prevail. And if you prevail, then you are going to get what you desire. If you bring a, and what these types of clauses are designed to prevent are people who are bringing frivolous, non-meritorious claims, but bring them anyway, almost automatically, in order to get leverage to delay the settlement of an estate or a trust at a settlement. So if there is merit in a claim for duress or undue influence or incapacity, then the person who brings that claim is going to prevail, and they're going to obtain, either they're going to have the will set aside in those situations or the trust set aside. And then they're going to have another remedy, depending on their variety of remedies that common law provides to deal with those situations. I don't know if that's an adequate, if that gives you enough comfort or not.
Well, this is Dick Thwaites again. Actually, AS 1312.051, which is who may make a will, is one sentence that says an individual 18 years of age or more who is of sound mind may make a will. And then the notes to the decisions go on for pages about undue influence, old age, debility, sickness, presumptions, and so forth. And likewise, under 1312.504, we have the provisions regarding self-proving wills, wherein the witnesses to the execution of the will are required via an affidavit to swear to the fact that they witnessed the will in the presence and hearing of the person signing the will, that to the best of the witness's knowledge, that the person signing the will at the time was 18 years of age or older, of sound mind, and under no constraint or undue influence. And oftentimes when you have, as a practitioner, when you have someone that is elderly and might not have the capacity to do a will, you often want witnesses who know the person and have a chance to independently talk to that person. As a protective measure, you might expand, at least my practice has been to expand on the self-proving provisions in the affidavit form, where there is some question that perhaps the person might have been lucid at the time of execution, but may have some issues because of medication or other things at other times. So the witnesses can attest to the willingness and impromptu and no undue influence and so forth of the testator. So there are provisions in the statutes that deal with that sort of thing already.
Gentlemen, I've got a couple of questions here. First from Representative Holmes and then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. And thank you. This has been real helpful in making me feel better. I do have one last thing, though, that I'm struggling with on this provision, which is I understand if you contest and you win, then it's fine. And you actually, you won your case, that's fine, everything's good. What if you have a legitimate case, or you have at least a clearly non-frivolous case? You really think there was duress, you think there was undue influence, you think there was something else going on, and you bring the case, let's back up. You think you've got a decent case, but you don't know. You're kind of rolling a dice like you do when you're litigating. Are you going to not bring that case even though you think there was duress because you realize if you roll the dice and you lose, you could lose everything? I mean, are we going to keep people from challenging in cases where we might actually want the challenge to occur because there might have actually been duress or undue influence because the person cannot be, I mean, if they win and that's great, but they might not and they might lose everything. And are we actually chilling some lawsuits that we might want to see go forward because there really was something off color going on?
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, which representative was that?
Sorry, this is Lindsay, Dave.
Oh, yes, Representative Holmes. You're right on. I mean, you put your finger right on it. But the decision, I mean, the key to this, to the theory in this area, is the decision is the testator's. For the settlors. In other words, that discussion that I described before, exactly what you're talking about, occurs with the person who's drafting, whose will it is, or whose trust it is. And they are saying, and we hear this frequently, and if you discuss this with clients, matter of fact, I would say the vast majority of time, clients say, I don't want this contested. So I don't want people litigating it. And so I guess the bottom line is, if there really is something wrong and they're willing to, depending on how this provision is written, it can be a moderate penalty or it can be a penalty written that says you lose your inheritance. So the child, in our example before, has to make that decision. Child's mother, Lindsay Holmes, or whomever it, the person who is the testator, that will has made a decision, and that decision is, I don't want this litigated, even if probable cause exists. I do not want my family involved in litigation. I don't want them fighting over my estate. Now, if there's something terribly wrong and they're going to win, they can go ahead and do it, and they will do it in that situation.
Very, very good, Mr. Schaftel. Representative Grunberg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Grunberg is here.
Thank you.
He's in the House.
I don't know if I'm all here. The 1312.517, which is the section in Section 1 of the bill that we're dealing with, is would make it enforceable, make these kinds of clauses enforceable. Right now, in the trust portion of the Uniform Probate Code, 1336.330, it has the same language as will be in this section if the bill passes. So this simply conforms the will portion of the probate code to the trust portion of the probate code. I assume you've gone over that?
Yes. Yes, you missed it.
Okay. And I'm wondering, since these were both entered at about the same time, the will provision was added in 1996 and the trust in 1998. David, do you know why they took the opposite approach in those two statutes?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunberg, the answer to that is, I think, as simple and straightforward as the group of attorneys who were recommending these changes, of which I was one, simply overlooked it. They both should have been done at the same time. They weren't. We were more focused on trusts. The change was made for trusts, but it should have been made for wills.
Okay. And if I may, Mr. Chair,
Normally
frivolous lawsuits are dealt with an award of higher attorney's fees under Rule 82. What is the interplay between these statutes and the normal penalty for frivolous lawsuits, and it's actually in Rule 95 and Rule 82, which allows, can be actual attorney's fees. You want to comment on that, Mr. Schaftel, through the chair?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunberg, I think the reality is that litigation, probate litigation, is more vulnerable to the abuses. I mean, and this is historic. We've all heard about will contests. I mean, recently, we've all, of course, been exposed to a great deal of high-level publicity dealing with a will contest of some very well-known people back east. But this area is more vulnerable to abuse and delay, and essentially bringing pressure for settlement, and that's been the experience of practitioners. So and on top of that, the person who is challenging it may not be able to pay the attorney's fees of the other parties. So that may not be really a deterrent. So I think that is why these types of clauses, these penalty clauses, which are, this isn't just Alaska. Every state has these kinds of clauses in one form or another and has dealt with them in one form or another. Sometimes very complex statutory provisions as to, deciding when somebody has the right to bring a lawsuit without suffering a penalty and when not to.
Mr. Schaftel, I think you've made a compelling point. You have satisfied Representative Grunberg, which...
Yeah, they're judgment proof.
Which is...
Yeah.
Which is
a feat.
An excellent accommodation.
I have one more thing to say. No.
With that, Representative Samuels.
I actually do have one more thing on the second part of the bill.
Representative Samuels.
And once again, as the layman here, going off the sponsor statement, life insurance and retirement benefits not subject to the claims of the creditor. Somebody can just maybe walk me through the, I understand the.
What section are you on?
The concept of it. I'm just reading the sponsor statement on what the concept of the bill is rather than trying to read the lawyer's version of the bill itself.
That's so much fun.
It seems that you could open yourself up to gamesmanship on the creditors, also in leaving just somebody holding the bag there. So somebody can walk me through the thinking behind that, the problem that you're trying to solve. And I think you could probably see my problems with it. If I'm going to go do something, gar a bunch of money in my name, leave it to the kids. I mean, there's all sorts of gamesmanship you can do to try to hide money from the creditors, to try to keep it in the family.
Can one of you gentlemen take us through that concern expressed by Representative Samuels? Please cite a specific a page and line for we laymen.
And we lawyers.
Well, this is Richard Thwaites. Specifically, I think the idea behind, originally when the probate code came into existence, in 1969, we had the, and this goes up to the provision there talking about the $25,000 and the $100,000.
No.
It was a limit that has carried through without any adjustment in the probate code all the way to the present. The effort, I think, here was to look at the smaller estates. Typically, what you have as a small practitioner is you'll have a $5,000 life insurance policy or a little IRA account or something like that in a small estate that would normally be under what one would consider the level of exemptions you'd normally want to provide a family that was caught off guard by someone passing on prematurely and wanting those things that larger estates and those with bigger assets do a little more careful planning with.
Sir, you've satisfied Representative Samuels.
Thank you.
There are other comments from the committee with regard to the language in House Bill 196. I don't see any. So, Representative Groomer,
For child support claims, let's say somebody dies who owes a lot of child support and has put all of his assets into a life insurance or an annuity policy. Would that be also immune from child support claims? Through the chair.
Again, this is Dick Thwaites, through the chair. I didn't draft this provision, so I'm not quite sure. My understanding of child support is it has something referred to as a super lien, and it oftentimes goes to IRAs and things like that that are otherwise not available to other creditors.
Representative Grunberg?
I am concerned a little bit about that and taxes and stuff like that. I don't know. I've never had to get into this, but in family law, obviously, sometimes people do all kinds of things to hide money from child support claims.
So this would only, this is a rhetorical question, gentlemen, unless I'm mistaken. This only applies to small estates. That's what we just covered. So any state of any substance which would be above the threshold of $25,000 in value, not including $100,000 worth of vehicles, any other estate would be subject to a child support claim. This is really for micro estates.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Poor people, often obligors, people who owe child support, are often only required to pay maybe $50 or $100 a month. And if you have a $15,000 estate, that could be 150 months, which is more than 10 years worth of child support.
Yes, I don't know that that this bill can cover every potential situation, and I don't know that the chair is as concerned about affording coverage to that unique subset of people that would be vulnerable exposed to this. Representative Holmes?
I don't know the answer either, but I'm sympathetic to what where Representative Grunberg's going on this. If you have a child involved and there is back child support due, I think the idea is that's as has been mentioned, it's sometimes subject to something called a super lien because society has decided that's such an important exception is to make sure that somebody's children are taken care of. And I'm wondering whether we can get a little more guidance on whether or not that might be an exemption to this rule, because I would think that would be a pretty important public policy issue. Is, you know, there may not be very much money left, but, you know, should it be going to the person's children?
So the subject matter, hold on one moment, gentlemen. So the subject matter, because I'm a layperson, I want to understand this also. Mm-hmm. So what you're referring to is if I have a child, mm-hmm. and I have not paid the child nor the mother the child support due, and I have a girlfriend, and I die, and I leave all the money to the girlfriend, then the child and the child's mother get screwed.
Correct.
Is that layman's understanding?
It's layman's language.
Okay. Correct.
Is there a specific language or conceptual amendment that you'd like to offer at the appropriate time to address this, or do you want to hear from legal counsel about this? I just don't want to get into a situation mm-hmm. where we have attorneys massaging the bill. So I want to stay with the specifics of the bill and make sure that we're enjoying forward progress and not just swimming in circles.
I don't, Mr. Chairman, have a specific language. I think the question is it might already be taken care of.
Okay.
It might be a sort of, as he mentioned, a super lien that's already in here. We're looking for somebody to answer that question.
Gentlemen, is there somebody that can answer that? Representative Grunberg, first.
Mr. Thwaites, through the chair, or Mr. Schaftel, or anybody, would it be possible for you to easily find out the answer to our question?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunberg, we can find that out, but I'm wondering if you have a representative, Mary Ellen Beardsley, online. She's with the AG's office, and I know they're concerned about child support. Mary Ellen, are you still online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mary Ellen Beardsley. What I would like to do is actually contact the Assistant Attorney General who deals with child support and see if I can't come up with an answer for this question. I have not been contacted by any of the attorneys. They may not be aware that there is this possible concern. I do agree that there is a concern, and I know that child support would like to have it addressed if there is a need to have it addressed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, one other comment, and I'm not sure that this has been adequately explained.
This is Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
This is an existing statute that we're talking about right now that has an exemption of $15,000. And it's what we call a smaller affidavit probate approach, so that you can avoid the whole probate procedure and all the formalities and cost of that. You have a very small estate, and the personal representative can go in, file an affidavit. The affidavit basically says that this person is the personal representative and they're entitled to collect these proceeds without going through this procedure. And this procedure right now exists in the law, but the amount is $15,000. This particular amendment increases it by $10,000 to $25,000. I'm sure that's probably no more than an inflation
Mr. Chef,
increase. It really isn't changing the law at all. It also adds a provision dealing with vehicles,
because
of these small estates, basically what you find is a bank account and a couple of cars or a boat or something like that, and this allows the an easy way, without going through the formalities of probate, to deal with...
Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, sir.
We all understand what's in it. What we're trying to do is address the concern of two members here that we're negatively affecting a vulnerable subset of people with child support. So that's specifically the concern that we have. We all are now pretty familiar with the contents, and we recognize that we're just adjusting this up from $15,000 to $25,000. But I believe that two of our members are concerned, at least two of our members are concerned, that there has been an oversight in statute, and so that's the remedy that they're trying to address, is a remedy that would have existed at the $15,000 level had they seen it at the time.
And Mr. Chairman, perhaps an easy way to fix
Mr. Schaftel.
Include the requirement in the affidavit that the person has to submit.
He's on a phone, so his phone's getting pressed.
There is no child support owing at the time.
In the future, if I can do that for you. Representative Gruenberg?
Yes. Now, my staff points out, first of all, that he is not certain, and I don't know, whether Section 4, which is AS 13.33, only applies to small estates. I don't know about that, but I do see that the statute that does apply to small estates, which is Section 2 of the bill, now will include, it goes up, as you can see on lines 5 and 6, from $15,000 to $25,000 in personal property, plus $100,000 in vehicles. And an anecdote, we had a guy do our floor in our house, and he asked to be paid in cash. And he went out, and he immediately bought guns. And he later appeared at the top of the people in the state who owed hundreds of thousands of dollars in child support. So people can turn this money into cars and stuff like that. So I do have a legitimate concern.
Certainly do. Is this the only concern that we have surrounding House Bill 196, to the knowledge of the members now being familiar with the bill? Mary Ellen, do we have somebody that we're contacting on this specific point relative to child support?
Mr. Chairman, I can contact someone. I don't have the ability to do so right now, but I can get an answer to the committee probably within a day, if that would be helpful.
No, that would not be helpful. We are backlogged with a dozen bills and holding things for these considerations.
Mr. Chairman.
This is not helpful. Representative Coghill.
Is this the only committee referral then?
This is the only committee referral.
The rules amendment, I'll agree with. 4 minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Certainly the next time we meet, if we need an amendment, we can deal with it quickly. If we don't, we can pass it out instantly.
Does that meet with the... needs the committee, Representative Lynn.
Could we not attempt to pass the bill out of committee this time and maybe entertain an amendment if needed in the Rules Committee or even on the House floor, but particularly in the Rules Committee?
I think it would be more appropriate here in the Judiciary Committee for us to take this up. But if the committee is in agreement of the rest of the language of House Bill 196, then the chair is prepared to set this bill aside and to take up an amendment in a prompt fashion, as long as we don't return to debating the rest of the language in the bill.
I apologize, but I do think it's
that's a good point.
Okay. All right. Let me ask if gentlemen, if you'll just stand by. Is there any other public comment here in the room, Representative Gruenberg?
I would just ask the folks on the line to please contact my office at 465-4940, 1-866-465-4940. Norman Cohn will be handling this.
Very good. And so, Representative Gruenberg, will you take responsibility then for having a draft an amendment?
Absolutely, and I'll circulate it.
An amendment without amendments? Just a one rock-solid amendment?
Yes, sir.
On Tuesday. Yes. All right. So is there any public comment? Is there any public comment here in the room or anybody online who wishes to testify on House Bill 196? Seeing none, public testimony is closed on House Bill 196, and we will be setting House Bill 196 aside for a prompt revisit on Tuesday to address a specific amendment. that correct, Representative Grunberg?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. With that, we're going to now take up House Bill 197, which we will be hearing and setting aside for the purposes of a specific amendment by Representative Grunberg on Tuesday.
Yes. Do you want me to put that on the record?
Oh, I just did.
I need to declare a potential conflict in why I'm doing it. I don't want to be unethical here.
Yes. First,
at some point.
Yeah, wait, yes. First, we have House Bill now one. We've set aside House Bill 196. We have House Bill 197 before us. We're going to attempt to have the same approach, which is to take up all the considerations of the bill, open and close public testimony, then address all the concerns that are before us, and then we will hold House Bill 197 pending a specific amendment by Representative Grunberg over a specific concern as it relates to uniform gifts under to a minor act.
Uniform transfers to minors.
Yes, sir. So with that, Jane, if you would take us through House Bill 197, and it will be our intent to actually get through House Bill 201 this afternoon so that we can show evidence of some having been here and completed some work product.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, committee aide to the House Judiciary Committee, and I'd like to read the definition of trust into the record. A trust is defined as property interest held by one person as a trustee at the request of another, the settlor, for the benefit of a third party who is the beneficiary. Therefore, a trust involves three elements, namely, one, a trustee who holds the trust property and is subject to equitable duties to deal with it for the benefit of another, two, a beneficiary to whom the trustee owes equitable duties to deal with the trust property for their benefit, and three, trust property that is held in trust for the beneficiary. The goal of this legislation is to make the state of Alaska the premier place for trust in estates. It is important that Alaska stay competitive with other states that do not have personal income taxes. The trust industry is important to the state of Alaska. It provides employment for accountants, attorneys, insurance agents, bankers, and their support staffs. There is between 30 to 70 million on deposit with Alaska banks through the Alaska Trust Company alone. There are also 1,000 clients who have trusts in Alaska due to their unique trust laws. Alaska has passed over 15 pieces of legislation since 1997 to keep the industry vibrant and competitive. And I can go through what this bill will accomplish quickly. Shares in professional corporation may be held by trustees of professionals' revocable trust. It expands the coverage of AS 1336-157, which allows the trustee of a trust to transfer trust assets to a similar trust. This expansion will only occur if the trust has an Alaskan trustee and the trust is primary administration is in Alaska. It allows the Alaska trustee of a charitable trust to change the percentage of the value of the trust that will be considered income whenever the trustee determines that the new percentage is necessary and prudent. It clarifies that a settlor's express intention to protect trust assets from beneficiaries' potential future creditors is not evidence as an intent to defraud. It states needed provisions relating to trustees' compensation, accepting or declining trusteeships, co-trustees, vacancy, resignation, removal, delivery of property by a former trustee, reimbursement of expenses, and certification of the trust.
And gentlemen, we have before us House Bill 197, Representative Holmes?
No, I said no? Ladies, too.
Because of Ms. Pearsley. She's addressing House Bill 201. Gentlemen, do you have remarks on House Bill 197, and can you put it into some kind of context for us, please?
This is Douglas Blotmacher. This bill does a number of things. It just allows that revocable trust can hold shares of a professional corporation shares in that corporation. Currently now it says that professional has to own them directly, but many people use revocable trust for planning purposes, and this just provides more flexibility. The other provision is that We now have a provision that allows a trustee that has certain powers the ability to transfer those assets into a similar trust for that beneficiary, as long as it doesn't take away any benefits to that beneficiary. But currently that only provides for if it's a trust that exists that started in Alaska. This allows trusts that are transferred to Alaska that has an Alaska trustee and has elected its administration be done in Alaska to allow the trustee to have the same power. And the main provisions here relate to trustee provisions that sometimes aren't in trusts, such as how a trustee can be removed, how a trustee can be appointed if there isn't a trustee, how the trustee's compensation should be set forth if the trust doesn't have these provisions. They're just really default provisions if a trust doesn't have one. And a lot of older trusts and sometimes newer trusts don't have these provisions. So it's just kind of a fallback protection so there's a clear avenue of how things should be taken care of if the trust is silent.
Very good. We've been joined by Steve Greer, who wants to comment on House Bills 196 and 197. Mr. Greer, we've set House Bill 196 aside. Do you have some salient comments on House Bill 197?
No. It's all I can say, and it's probably been stated before, I'm joining this meeting late, and I'm sure that Mr. Schaftel has already indicated that this is gone through a very extensive process with the state planning attorneys here in Alaska, and we've had numerous discussions over the last 6 or 7 months trying to come together with respect to these bills and what would be good for Alaska. I don't have any specific things I'd like to add other than the fact that all these laws would very much improve the trust law that we currently have in Alaska.
Very good. And Mr. Greer, can you tell us who you're with? Or
yes, I'm a sole practitioner here in Anchorage. I've been very involved in the last 4 or 5 years, with the legislature and helping to draft legislation, improving our trust laws. But I represent only myself. I don't represent a trust company. And in fact, my interests, really, if you were to identify them, would be to protect those interests of the normal Alaska beneficiary.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Representative Grunberg.
May I have leave of the chair to ask if Mr. Greer does have any comment on 196 he'd like to share with us?
No.
Yeah, I do have something on 196 that I'd like to add. Is that this is really meant to protect the little guy. So often, people have life insurance there to protect their family in the event that they were to pass away, and the life insurance benefits and IRA benefits as well are meant be there to protect the family, and so we would like to have these things being able to be paid to the family, and excluded from any creditor claims that might be otherwise be applicable against the estate.
Follow-up question, Representative Grunberg.
May I ask the question that remains out? Maybe he knows the answer.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Okay, I had a question, Steve. This is Max Grunberg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And nobody knew the answer.
Okay.
If there's an unpaid claim for child support, will people be able to shield that now? Shield, so that they can put their money into cars or something, and because there's some language in 196 that shields this money from creditors. Does that?
Through the chair, if I may, re-ask the question, is that, for instance, let's just say an individual had a life insurance policy in his life. He named his spouse's, you're actually looking for a child support. So you have a single individual.
That's all we care about, Mr. Greer. It's just the child support question. That's it. If you don't have an answer on that issue, we've really already set 196 aside. We're only interested if there's an outstanding child support amount that's due.
And I would have no objection to having that included in this bill.
Very good. Thank you. We're back to House Bill 197.
Thank you for the leave, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. All right, Mr. Greer, thank you for your remarks on 197. Mr. Dave, Doug, and Richard, can you take us through any of the salient points of 197, and then Representative Gruenberg, we will have you speak to your concerns about the Uniform Gift to Minors Act and the amendment that you want to make on that.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Dave Shaftel. I think both Jane Pearson and Doug Blockmacher have summarized the basic intent of House Bill 197. Really, there was a big void in the law dealing with trustees, what happens when with trustee compensation, with when trustees resign, when new trustees need to be appointed, when you have several trustees, how do they vote? All of those kinds of things, we did not have default rules in the statutes. Now, if you're dealing with sophisticated clients who hired competent counsel, all of those provisions would be in their wills or their trusts. But what these provisions do here is to, as Steve Greer has already pointed out, help protect the little guy who may not have had as thorough estate planning from the professionals, or may have even tried to do the estate planning himself or herself. What these provisions are default provisions, will apply to that will or trust to deal with these trustee questions if they have not been adequately covered in the document that was prepared. That's the what most of this bill is about. There are several other provisions in it, but be happy to answer any specific questions.
Representative Gruenberg, would you please speak to your conflict and then to the question that you want to bring before us?
Yes, may I ask Mr. Shaftel a question first?
Yeah.
There's one provision here that is explained in paragraph 2 of the sponsor's statement. It deals with 1336.157, which appears to allow somebody to transfer their assets from one trust to another. And my question is, if there is a creditor who's trying to get at the assets of one trust, could somebody under this set up another trust and transfer the assets to escape that creditor?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that would be a fraudulent transfer and it would be set aside.
Thank you. Now, let me put on the record my concern.
Yes.
Under the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, normally account, the custodial account, trust account, terminates at age 21, but it can go as low as 18 or as high as 25. There's nothing explicit in the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act that would, in an appropriate case, allow the establishment of a trust and the placement of those assets into the trust if the beneficiary was not capable of caring for those trust assets at the age of 25. It was financially irresponsible, something like that. And we have asked to have the bill held till Tuesday so that the lawyers can work on this. I'm in that situation with my own son now. I have to put that on the record. And it could be a material problem for a number of people who set up these accounts with kids who are running the street and stuff like that. And we would like to have the ability to, either with or without a court approval, as the legislature determines, place these into a really neutrally managed trust so that they're not dissipated. And I have to disclose that on the record. That's actually facing me today.
To Mr. Gruenberg through the chair, this is Dick Thwaites. I would have some concerns that the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act and so forth was set up and approved primarily because of IRS gifting restrictions and so forth. And that should be carefully looked at in any modifications that are done.
Thank you, through the chair. Absolutely. If we can talk with you about that, Trigg Davis is my attorney. I want to be sure that we do not upset anything IRS-wise, and I'm not going to even go into that. I mean, I don't want to jeopardize that at all, but thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gruenberg. Dave Shaftel again. This is a controversial area, Representative Gruenberg, that's often discussed on listservs and among estate planning attorneys, and it's not a simple area to resolve. I just expressed the concern that to find the drafting and the approach that you may want to use here may take some time and some research, and might, if you tag it on to this particular bill, might have the effect of this bill not passing this session.
I'm not going to do it if that's the case, Mr. Chair. We'll look at that if necessary separately. So I will withdraw my request.
Very good. Are there questions for our attorneys on House Bill 197? Mr. Shaftel or one of the other gentlemen on the line, do you feel that there is other elements of this bill that you want to bring to our attention?
This is Dick Twait. Just something that everybody should know, that in Alaska we allow holographic wills. It has, in my 30 years of or plus of doing this, it has been a common event for someone out in rural Alaska to sit down and draw up a will that essentially says, I leave everything in trust. End of story to my kids. And this bill goes a huge distance towards stretching over that gap.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
So this bill will help people effectuate that desire. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Good.
Is there any more public testimony on House Bill 197? Do we have anybody else online? We heard from Mr. Greer. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 197? Public testimony is closed. Bring it back to the committee. So, Representative Gruenberg, you're not going to pursue this for fear of upsetting the IRS apple cart as it relates
well,
to...
Well, let me put it this way, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to do that in this committee. I may have the attorneys talk to each other. Okay. To determine whether down the line that could be done, but I do not. I'm not about to delay this.
Then in that case, if there is Representative Lynn,
move the bill when you're ready.
Is there any additional committee discussion on House Bill 197? And Representative Gruenberg, if in subsequent discussions you feel that an amendment on the House floor is appropriate, I'll be happy to help you if it makes sense and integrates into this House bill as it relates.
Thank you. You have my word, and my friends on the line have my word. I'm not going to do anything to jeopardize the bill.
Okay. With that, Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 197, 25-LS0444, /E, with individual recommendations, and there's no fiscal note there.
Zero.
It was?
Zero.
There are? Yes, and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection from the committee, House Bill 197 passes from House Judiciary. Thank you very much for your cooperation. Let's go off the record just for a second. Ledoux, it's a pleasure to have you in the House Judiciary Committee. House Bill 201.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee. I'm Gabrielle Ledoux, representative from House District number 36, and I am here just initially to introduce House Bill number 201, which is the Uniform Disclaimer of Property Interests Act. And I'd like to introduce my aide, Sonia Heimer, who is going to explain the bill.
Definitely done.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Sonia Heimer with staff to Representative Ledoux.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I'd like to provide a short introduction to House Bill 201. we also have experts online to answer technical questions and go into the bill in more detail. Just basically, this bill would enact the Uniform Disclaimer of Property Interests Act, which has been approved by the American Bar Association and has already been enacted in 13 states. The Uniform Law Commission approached us to sponsor this bill, and we agreed to do that. And basically, a disclaimer extinguishes an interest as if it had never existed. And this bill sets up a clear procedure for beneficiaries of interest, which are received, for instance, through a will or inheritance or a trust, and it allows the beneficiaries to disclaim those interests as if they had never existed. And here's a simple example would be a parent leaves the family farm to his three children. Two of the children don't live on the farm anymore, and they want to leave it to the third child who continues to live on the farm and work there. So the first two children could disclaim their interests and therefore leave 100% of the farm to the third child. The Uniform Law Commission drafted the original version of this bill, which I've included in your committee packets, and it includes extensive commentary on each section. So as I mentioned, there are experts online, including a Uniform Law Commissioner in Fairbanks, and so I will turn this over to them to continue the presentation.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Samuel?
Thank you. I guess for either for yourselves or for the people online, what happens if nobody wants it? There's a buried fuel tank, and the dad dies. You don't want the liability associated with it, so it just goes away. And does the bill only come into play if there's a will or a trust? I mean, where somebody passes away, you can't shed some liability just because you don't want the property anymore. You're going to.
Once you accept the property, you can't disclaim it. So it's only when you stand to receive some property. So I would like to defer to Mary Ellen Beard, who's online.
Mary Ellen, are you still with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Thank you. Can you comment on Representative Samuel's concern?
I'm assuming that if there was a disclaimer by all beneficiaries, of whatever nature that existed, that ultimately, if this is like real property or any type of property that has maybe some problems with it, it could ultimately escheat to the state. It is rare that that happens, but it is a possibility.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Greenberg?
Is there anybody else going to testify on the bill?
We have our three gentlemen, Dave, Doug, and Richard, all available to comment on House Bill 201.
I don't think I have to ask them. My comments go solely to Article 2, which is on the last page of the bill, and the title.
We also have Lynn Levengood. Is with us in Fairbanks, my friend Lynn, our friend Lynn, who's with the Alaska Uniform Law Commission. Before that, just for a moment of housekeeping, can I get somebody to move the CS again?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I was going to mention that there's a CS which makes a small technical change.
Mr. Chairman, is that the E version? Is that the version that's the CS?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the CS for House Bill 201, version E, Bannister, dated 3/31/07.
I will object to ask a question. If you or anybody would please tell us what the change or changes are between this and the original bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenberg, the original bill included a sort of a transition between the existing disclaimer law, 1312801, mm-hmm. and the present law. The law disclaimer law in effect right now includes a 9-month deadline. The bill before you does not include a deadline. And so the original bill included a transition provision. However, upon further examination of the official comments that go with the Uniform Act, it was decided that that transition was unnecessary because it's taken care of in the comments. And if you'd like, I think, more detail than I've been able to provide, I think I'd have to defer to, again, to the people online.
Through the chair, taken care of in what comments?
The official comments to the Uniform Disclaimer Act, which was drafted by the Uniform Law Commission.
So in order to determine the transitional effect, somebody's going to have to go to the Uniform Act and looked in the comments. Mm-hmm. I think that's a dangerous precedent.
Mr. Chairman, may I address this issue?
Yes, Marianne, let me just have Representative Gruenberg complete his...
No, please.
Okay, Mary Ellen, go ahead, please.
This is Mary Ellen Beardsley. The reason that initially we did feel that legal services for the legislature did think that there was a need for a transition. We then discussed it, and if you look at page 8, 1370-140, which deals with application of existing relationships, our reading of this was that that actually deals with this issue, and that the transition language in Section 3 was basically redundant and unnecessary. And therefore, the CS is proposed. It simply takes out Section 3.
I see. I will remove my objection.
And we have before us the CS for House Bill 201. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions relate solely to Article 2 of the bill on the last page. I have several questions and concerns about that, more in the nature of trying to solve a problem than really a complaint. First of all, I would suggest that we include spousal support as well as child support. Normally, in this day and age, when we deal with the support issue, the Child Support Enforcement Division, that also has jurisdiction over spousal support. And I would like to make, and at the appropriate time, a conceptual amendment to include spousal support, which is only done rarely in cases of need or education, something like that. But I'll make that the appropriate time.
Can we go to Lynn Levengood? Lynn, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I am Lynn Levengood, attorney in Fairbanks, Alaska. I am one of the Alaska's commissioners on the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws. While this legislation has been passed in 13 other jurisdictions, the committee substitute that's before you was drafted by the administration, and Mary Ellen Beardsley is the expert who can testify as to the specific language. However, after it was drafted, it was provided to the National Conference on Uniform State Laws, and they approved it as a uniform act. So it's very, very, very close to the uniform language that was originally provided, but there is some Alaska specifics to it, and any questions in that regard will be addressed by Mary Ellen Beardsley. If there is any questions regarding specific language that's in the body of the bill that came from the National Conference, I'm the point of contact on this legislation, and I would have to take any technical questions regarding the language back to the Uniform or State Law Conference in Chicago to get a detailed explanation. But so that's all the comments I have today, and I guess I would refer any technical questions regarding this committee substitute to Mary Ellen Beardsley.
Well, Lynn, it's Jay Rammers. It's nice to hear your voice. I hope you're doing well.
Thank you. It's about 40 degrees and overcast in Fairbanks.
Good. We all miss our friend from Fairbanks, who I know you were a close confidant of counseling him in the Senate Judiciary over the last couple of years. So it's nice to have you over on this side of the building.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and with that, I'll conclude my comments and pass the microphone to Ms. Beardsley.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
My comments, by the way, have nothing to do with the Uniform Act, because this little Article 2 is not the Uniform Act. It's totally outside it. Number two, in conjunction with that, Representative Ledoux through the chair, when we deal with this, I would suggest that we narrow the title on page 1, line 2, so it doesn't just say, quote, to child support or to child and spousal support, but we make clear it's to disclaimers relating to. Otherwise, this is going to be a barn door title that anybody can put in anything on child or spousal support, stuff that doesn't have anything to do with the bill. There was one other thing, too.
To that end, I'll be introducing an amendment on predatory fish.
Predatory disclaimers. May I continue, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, please.
I don't know, and this is kind of to Ms. Beardsley, but the language on page 10, lines 9 and 10, I don't know whether that would also include paternity actions. Ms. Beardsley, may I ask directly through the chair? Thank you.
Yes, certainly.
Ms. Beardsley, does the language on page 10, lines 9 and 10, and the rest of Article 2, would that clearly apply if there's no child support proceeding pending to a potential paternity action? Because I could see somebody disclaiming to avoid being named in a paternity suit, too. I'd like to be sure that doesn't occur.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I really don't have an answer for that. I can tell you that when we were drafting this bill, I was in close contact with the assistant AG dealing who represents the Child Support and Enforcement Agency, and we came up with this language that you see in Article 2. Their primary concern is child support, and spousal support was not addressed, so I don't know if they even considered that. And as to a paternity action, again, it was not part of the discussions, but if a paternity action has been initiated, then it depends on when it occurred. Did it occur before or after? I mean, has there been any child support also determination at the time? Quite often, child support determinations or proceedings will occur prior to a paternity action, or sometimes it will occur afterwards. What I can do, again, is go back to the actual experts in this area. I do not deal with child support on a daily basis. And I'd be glad to get an answer to all of these questions that you've raised.
And Mr. Chair, if I may continue. Yes, please. These are a very important. I don't think you can have a child support action before you have a paternity establishment unless that has been established, like with an acknowledgement on a birth certificate. But that is already an establishment of paternity. And I could see a potential circumstance, having practiced in this area for so long and seen how many people do how many weird things to get out of paying any support, I could see somebody disclaiming everything they possibly could, or a particular valuable piece of property of some type, not even when they're in arrears. If they're not in arrears yet, for example, let's say somebody's in a pending divorce and they want to get out of paying any support, so you don't yet have any arrearage, and you don't yet have any pending court or administrative proceeding. I would like to see this language, if I may, work on it over the weekend or whatever, tightened, because we are going to find that people are going to use this as part of their divorce plan.
Mr. Chairman?
Out of paying.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Dave Shaftel, Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunberg. This area of disclaimers that we're talking about is something that is very central to the trust and estate area. We're dealing with assets that a person inherits, not assets that they already own. And so it's only if Max, your dad, dies and leaves you $10,000, at that point, and for federal tax purposes, it has to be within 9 months, you can disclaim that $10,000, and if you disclaim it, then it will go as if you had died before your dad. And that's what this disclaimer area is all about. It's a very central area in estate and trust administration, and we use it all the time. It's a very important area. One thing that concerns me and the other practitioners I've talked to when we were alerted that this uniform statute had been submitted was that we hadn't had an opportunity to really review it. Now, previously, as you well know, we have a group of attorneys, an informal group that's been working on trust and estate legislation since 1997. We have had other uniform acts come through, and to give you a specific example, the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which was enacted several years ago, and that was one where I worked on that with other members of our group for about a year and a half to make sure that the Uniform Act was tweaked according to what the national experts were telling us in other areas were advantageous provisions to enact so that Alaska would have the very best Uniform Principal and Income Act provisions. And I just would suggest for the committee's consideration that this might well be a very good procedure for this Uniform Disclaimer Act. I've looked at it quickly. It looks like it has a lot of good, solid provisions that would help us in Alaska, but to ensure that it's consistent with our other trust and estate provisions that we've worked so hard on and in the last 10 years, it would be worth giving us a chance to really study this, to talk to some people in other states who've looked at it, to look at all of our other trust and estate provisions and see how this meshes or what perhaps small adjustments need to be made to make sure that this works well with the existing new statutes we've enacted.
All right. Mr. Shaftel, what kind of timeline would be required for your group to give this such an overview?
Well, I can tell you that with the Uniform Principal and Income Act, we took a year and a half. In other words, it was introduced. It then was held by, I think, the House. Over the summer, we worked on it. We came back the next session with all of the provisions that we thought were appropriate, and it went right through that session. So it's worth being a little bit deliberate on these uniform acts. As has been discussed already, only 13 states have enacted this one so far. The other states are probably looking at it. We already have in existence 1312801, which has a number of these provisions, so we're okay for the time being. Certainly this act has some additional provisions that will fill some gaps, and as I say, it looks positive, but I think it would be very wise to take some deliberate study at this point and maybe get it enacted next year.
Representative Ledoux?
I would like to, I believe that Deborah Baer has talked with numerous estate attorneys in Anchorage, and it was my Anchorage and around the state, and it was my understanding that she had vetted this bill basically with the estate bar, and we could probably get her on the phone if need be.
Oh, certainly, yes, we will. Mr. Levengood, are you still with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
With the Uniform Law Commission, do you have a point of view on this, or do you share Mr. Schaftel's concern that we should take our time to better understand this, or do you have a position?
The language from the Uniform Commission was provided to the state attorneys back in, I believe, December. I was looking through my file, and I don't have the letter that was provided to them. And then in March, I guess, a few weeks ago, when 201 was actually drafted and put into the hopper, it was again sent around. I only received feedback actually just yesterday from Mr. Schaftel. So it was provided to persons in December of last year, and I received, like I said, only comments or any feedback yesterday. So that's all I guess I can tell the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Yes. This is Steve Greer. I was not involved in the drafting of this bill, but I will like to state a couple of things. I'm very, very active in the estate planning section of the Bar Association and attend meetings regularly. I don't recall this ever being introduced or even suggested at a section meeting. And I will say this, passage of this bill, I will guarantee you, will create a plethora of lawsuits against the normal attorney here in Alaska that draws up drafts a trust or a will, for the simple reason that 9-month period is being eliminated. The average attorney will look at the statute and think, geez, I can file a disclaimer at any point in time, but if they do it after the 9-month period, they've just malpracticed from a tax perspective. I would strongly recommend that we have a chance to look at this bill and work out some of the problems that apparently other states feel that there is with this bill. That's my only comment.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Representative Ledoux, I don't know if you were in the room when Mr. Greer joined us online, but he is an independent attorney who is just representing himself, whereas Mr. Schaftel, Blattmacher, and Thwaites were, assumed were invited by Judiciary.
They're with the Alaska Trust Company.
With the Alaska Trust Company, just so you understand the voices that are coming in. Ms. Bayer is coming across the street, is that right?
Right. She's on her way.
Are there any other questions for Representative Ledoux or for Mr. Greer or with the people at the Alaska Uniform Trust Company?
Oh, this is Dick Thwaites. Likewise have not had any contact regarding this until this morning, actually. Have been active in the estate planning community as an attorney, as a chair of the estate planning section and the elder law section. Actively use disclaimer provisions in all of the estate planning I do. And this is the first indication I've had, so I don't know where it's been directed or who's been doing that. I was very actively involved from the early 90s till the present with the current trust law that is in existence, and I concur with Attorney Schaftel.
Okay. Representative Coghill and then Grunberg.
Mr. Chairman, mine's only going to be a suggestion. Since we have 13 other states that have gone into this, and we have some very Alaska-specific issues, maybe the better thing for us to do is look at where the similarities and dissimilarities are in a side-by-side. So I would like to see that before I'd feel comfortable moving along, just because of the concern that's just been raised.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, my little thing is only on Article 2, and I'd need a few days to look at that. I want to be sure that we're covered on that, and I'm not at all familiar with the disclaimer of the estate planning stuff.
And I'm
Representative Ledoux.
You know, I want to work this out with all of the stakeholders. I've got no interest in moving this bill until the people who practice in this area are happy that it's something that they not only can live with, but will benefit them.
Ms. Bayer, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Deborah Bayer, an Assistant Attorney General employed by the Department of Law. I'm also a Uniform Law Commissioner for the state of Alaska. And I was observing the hearing by telephone, so I have some idea of where we're going. First of all, I think Representative Grunberg's ideas are good ones. I think they will fine-tune it, and I'll be happy to work with Representative Grunberg on those ideas.
I'll bring the family lawyers into it, too.
Yeah, and and that should not take a long period of time to do. It's just terminology changes. As to our working with the trust community, you heard Lynn Levengood. He did send letters out to people. I personally called people, and I'll be honest with you, I got no responses back. So I assumed there was no problems with it. If they have a problem with it, we, again, will be happy to work with anyone. We want law that works for the state of Alaska. This is a very short act. I wouldn't be surprised if everybody puts their energy on it. We would have something in the next week or so.
Mr. Schaftel, because you've come before the committee before, we have a concern raised by Representative Grunberg. We have desire for a side-by-side comparison from Representative Coghill. You've laid out a more draconian timeline of a year and a half to consider these bills. Do you think that if we satisfy the side-by-side comparison for Representative Coghill and address the family law considerations for Representative Grunberg, that this is something we can address in a more expedient fashion, or should we just put a tent up and wait till next January?
Mr. Chairman, those aren't the only issues that would arise with respect to disclaimers. Steve Greer's also pointed out the tax issues that he's concerned with. We have a number of other trust provisions we've enacted that can relate to disclaimers. As has been explained, I'm not sure where the uniform commissioners obtained their list of practitioners, but there must be 8 or 10 attorneys who have repeatedly appeared before House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary over the last 10 years who are very active practitioners, and none of us seem to have received this bill at an early date. So unless there's some urgency, if you're asking my opinion, and I don't see the urgency because we have an existing disclaimer statute in effect, these uniform laws are generated. There are dozens of them. Some of them, several are enacted by several states and aren't enacted elsewhere. Others are more popular, and many states enact them. Often we go to conferences, and there are discussions of these uniform laws and the problems with them and how states are enacting them and adjustments they're making. I don't see the urgency, quite frankly, and would urge some real deliberation, but that's my opinion.
Yes, sir. It's the desire of this committee or the chairman to assist Representative Ledoux in moving her bills along. I'm not sure who we would task with the side-by-side comparison, whether that's something that your office can address for us, Representative Ledoux, or whether it's something that would happen through the AG's office. But the request I would have from you, Mr. Schaftel, would be to, without drilling down too deep into the bill, if you could create some bullet point questions that are your concerns, and then we can make copies of that for the committee and determine whether they're substantive enough to hold the bill over, because your suggestion is really to hold the bill over the interim and come back and revisit it next January. And we like to move work product through this committee, but only in a responsible fashion. Representative Cargill?
One of the other pieces of information that was brought up that we may want to at least talk about, one testifier said a plethora of lawsuits could happen. It might be helpful to us to find out what that range may look like, what compared to what we have now in statute to this, what might be the possible challenges. We could look at the plain language but not know what the practical implications are. That's what I'm getting at.
I agree. So, Mr. Greer, our fax number here is 465-2070. We might ask you in summary form to address this concern that you spoke to about a plethora of lawsuits from the 9-month provision. Representative Gruenberg, if you'll work with Ms. Baer's office on spousal support provision in Article 2, and if Representative Ledoux, if you would be responsible for the side-by-side comparison vis-à-vis the prevailing information that the other 13 states have relative to ours. And Mr. Chaftel, if you could, without providing too extensive of the document, just highlight for us what the broader concerns are that you have on this bill. We can circulate those documents amongst the other committee members and decide whether this is something that we can responsibly take up through the duration of this session, which is the desire of the committee, or if it's something that we should hold over and allow the Uniform Law Commission to have an opportunity to address. We just want to move responsibly through this, but also honor the effort of Representative Ledoux. Representative Gruenberg.
May I ask an unusual request?
Don't you often?
We have Mr. Livengood, and I'm afraid, sir,
Levengood,
I'm sorry. And, of course, I know Ms. Baer for years. Do we have a third commissioner here? Is Grant Callow still a commissioner?
Grant is a life member. We have a number of uniform law commissioners.
A bunch of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we used to be blessed every year with Art Peterson, who would come and with one or more uniform laws to this committee. And I would just ask the uniform commissioners, I don't know if you get together or communicate, I would be very interested if we could get the benefit of your thinking on any uniform laws in any subject that you think that this committee should look at. They're very good, they're professionally done, and they help bring the laws among all the states uniform.
Who are we going to ask to?
If Ms. Baer could coordinate
call
that.
Call his office.
That'd be excellent.
Yeah.
That would be outstanding. We have a busy week.
Oh, no.
Next week.
No, I'm not thinking of a hearing or anything at this point. I'm just thinking that she could give us a list, like the Uniform Commercial Code updates, all kinds of things. They're a very good group.
Yes. All right. Representative Ledoux, are you comfortable with where we're leaving this at this point in time?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So we have different assignments, Mr. Greer, Mr. Chaftel, Ms. Baer working with Mr. Gruenberg, and then if your office will help us with the side-by-side relative to the other 13 states, and as an opportunity presents itself for this to come back up under bills previously heard, if the objections are not insurmountable, then we can certainly take this up in a prompt fashion.
All right.
Otherwise, we'll see you in January, it sounds like, according
thank
to Mr. Chaftel.
Thank
you very much. Are there any other comments from the Judiciary Committee? And Representative Gruenberg, before we part, I just want to remind you that we're going to be very swift and speedy on Tuesday in addressing the amendment, single amendment,
right,
on House Bill 196.
Right.
On the record.
Right.
Scout's honor.
Can I amend
I was it? An Eagle Scout. So
can I amend his amendment?
Yeah. That we're adjourned. 2:45.